Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the 9th day of November, 2019. I'm your host, Mark Hall. And when it comes to taking a look back at a week of insanity like this one, maybe we better start with a primary example, courtesy of a bit of TV propaganda called The View, including Joy Behar, and a summary via Nick Gibbous at Fox News, who says that politicians seeking to confiscate guns from Americans shouldn't share their plans with the public beforehand so that they can maintain an element of surprise, said the left-leaning liar Joy Behar on The View Monday. She was discussing former presidential hopeful and scumbag Robert Francis O'Rourke, a.k.a. the fake Hispanic Beto, and said it was foolish of him to actually announce his plans for gun confiscation up front before he was elected. And then she advised all politicians to wait and go after the country's guns once they've assumed office, put their hand on a Bible, of course, and lied through their teeth about what they intend to do. Quote, "They should not tell everything they're going to do. If you're going to take people's guns away, wait until after you're elected. Then take the guns away," said this particularly detestable example of the Hollywood left. "Don't tell them ahead of time." And the audience, of course, loves the lie.
Yeah, they should not tell everything they're going to do. Like, if you're going to take people's guns away, wait till you get elected, then take the guns away. Don't tell them ahead of time.
Also, detestable co-host Meghan McCain weighed in on the issue. I guess we don't have to wonder where she learned how to lie so well. And said O'Rourke had poisoned the well and scared off so-called independent voters from the lying Democrats, saying, quote, "I'll also say this on his stance on gun buybacks. Mayor Pete said it was a shiny object that distracts from achievable gun reform," she'd said earlier. That clip will be played for years with organizations that try and scare people by saying, well, exactly what they're doing, that, quote, "Democrats are coming for your guns," unquote. Oh, and she went on to say that Beto's statements about religious institutions, you know, the corporate 501c3 organizations having their tax-exempt status removed because they don't support so-called same-sex marriage, is evidently another proof that they'd better keep their mouth shut about what they really intend to do until after they're elected. So let me see if we can summarize the far-left media advice to the far-left candidates. Keep your mouth shut until after you're elected, for crying out loud. Then you can gang-rape the Constitution. And besides which, if you tell people beforehand, they'll save those clips and show that the conspiracy theorists have been right all along, and we can't have that either. Oh yeah, and we've already seen pretty graphic evidence about what happens to a candidate who says he's going to lock them up and dismantle the deep state, or drain the swamp, and then actually tries to follow through on that. Obviously, even attempting to honor your oath of office is now an impeachable offense. Covering up major news stories, however, is still a really big deal at the faux news networks. And James O'Keefe's Project Veritas seems to have done it again as far as exposing things that the three-letter propaganda agencies would just as soon you never hear about. And the latest expose from a real whistleblower, imagine that, as opposed to the fake stuff they do want to talk about, reveals that ABC News, sick, knew about Jeffrey Epstein's sex crimes, yet decided to ignore the whole mess, according to undercover footage now released by Project Veritas. Amy Robach, Good Morning America co-host and breaking news anchor at ABC, explained how a witness came forward years ago with information pertaining to Epstein, but the Disney-owned propaganda agency refused to air the material literally for years, and she vented her anger in a hot mic moment with an off-camera producer, explaining that ABC quashed the story early on, saying, "I've had this interview with Virginia Roberts, now Virginia Roberts Jeffrey, alleged Epstein victim, for a long time. We would not put it on the air. First of all, I was told, who's Jeffrey Epstein? No one knows who that is. Oh, and think about it, folks. They intended to keep that way. This," she continued, "they said, was a stupid story." And here's some of that introduction from their latest effort from Project Veritas.
"I've had the story for 3 years. I've had this interview with Virginia Roberts. We would not put it on the air. First of all, I was told, who's Jeffrey Epstein? No one knows who that is. This is a stupid story. Then the palace found out that we had her whole allegations about Prince Andrew and threatened us a million different ways. We were so afraid we wouldn't be able to interview Kate and Will that also quashed the story. And then Alan Dershowitz was also implicated in because of the planes. She told me everything. She had pictures. She had everything. She was in hiding for 12 years. We convinced her to come out. We convinced her to talk to us. It was unbelievable what we had. Clinton. We had everything.
And I guess, folks, that right there tells you all the reasons that we really need to know as to why it stayed secret. But let's finish it.
I tried for 3 years to get it on to no avail, and now it's all coming out, and it's like these new revelations, and I freaking had all of it. I'm so pissed right now. Like, every day I get more and more pissed because I'm just like, oh my God, what we had was unreal. Other women backing it up. Hey, yep. Brad Edwards, the attorney, 3 years ago saying, there will come a day when we will realize Jeffrey Epstein was the most prolific pedophile this country has ever known. And I had it all 3 years ago.
And let's see, 3 years ago, that would have been before the election, wouldn't it? Well, there's another reason. Maybe it's all the same reason. From there, yet another story that the Waste Stream really doesn't want to talk about. We've mentioned it before, but it bears repeating given new information. Turkish-backed jihadists, is the Zero Hedge headline, filmed using CIA-supplied missiles against none other than Syrian Kurds. Who's on whose team, you're probably thinking? It is really kind of tough to keep track. The Libertarian Institute's Scott Horton captioned the rare video accurately when he said the following. CIA's former moderate jihadist terrorist blasting DOD's Kurdish YPG friends with a U.S.-manufactured TOW missile. And yeah, I noted it's rather rare to get footage from this side, and it does seem to be exactly what it shows, says Zero Hedge. The CIA previously introduced the BGM-71 TOW anti-tank missiles to the Syrian battlefield, handing the advanced weaponry off to the so-called moderate rebels. What's the difference, folks? Well, they're supposedly on our team today, but that's subject to change and seems to quite a bit. It was all about arming the Free Syrian Army, SIC, in order to accomplish regime change against Assad as part of Operation Timber Sycamore, which of course failed. And critics of the CIA efforts in Syria were quick to point out that so much American hardware would inevitably, and perhaps even intentionally, say the cynics, including your host, go to the jihadists of ISIS and Al-Qaeda. Even the Waste Stream media and pundits were finally forced to document that this is precisely what happened. And now, the Turkish-backed Free Syrian Army, more commonly known as the Syrian National Army, is deploying the very same CIA-supplied TOW missiles against America's current proxy in Syria, the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces, as part of Erdogan's Operation Peace Spring. And if this sounds sickeningly familiar, by now it ought to. Real Clear Defense summarized the whole stinking mess this way. U.S. military may be targeted by its own missiles in the Middle East. From there on, we go to other obscenities and contradictions that the Waste Stream would just as soon ignore. The UK's Daily Mail is talking about it. They're not going to point out what I'm fixing to. At least 9 U.S. citizens south of the border in Mexico, including 6 children, who live in the Mexican border state of Sonora, were killed in a shooting attack on Monday. What? In completely gun-free Mexico? This is what the lying leftists say their gun confiscation is absolutely positively going to fix. Well, that is, outside of the public-private partnership between the terrorist drug gangs and the terrorist government. The victims, said the story, all belong to the LeBaron family, a breakaway Mormon community that settled in the hills of northern Mexico decades ago. And at the time of the attack, 17 of the family members were traveling in 3 different cars from the settlement. And according to relatives, drug cartel gunmen opened fire and then torched the vehicles so the victims that hadn't already been killed burned to death. Alfonso Durazo, so-called top security official for the state of Mexico, said on Tuesday, well, the cartel gunmen may have mistaken the group's large SUVs for rival gangs. And that, of course, is an invitation to die in gun-free Mexico. Let me add one more thing from the Daily Mail's coverage here, folks. I'm skipping over a whole lot of the incredibly grisly details. Yeah, what we've reported wasn't the half of it. This was a truly ugly, vicious mass murder that makes the worst of what the press fawns all over in the United States pale by comparison. Here, though, is the primary focus of the Daily Mail story. The slaughter of U.S. citizens on Mexican soil quickly became an international incident, with Trump on Tuesday who vowed to help Mexico wage a war on its drug cartels, which, if you think about it, folks, makes a hell of a lot more sense than waging whatever you want to call it in the Middle East on whoever it is that's the enemy du jour. Said the American president, if Mexico needs or requests help in cleaning out these monsters, the United States stands ready, willing, and able to get involved and to do the job quickly and effectively, tweeted Trump. The great new president of Mexico has made this a big issue, but the cartels have become so large and powerful, thank you, Barry, et al., your host interjects here, and that et al. Certainly includes the drug cartel's best friend, Mr. Fast and Furious, that you sometimes need an army to defeat an army. This, he continued, is the time for Mexico, with the help of the United States, to wage war, and he puts it all in caps, on the drug cartels and wipe them off of the face of the earth. We await merely a call from your great new president, unquote. Prompting that great new guy, the communist president Andrés Manuel López Obrador, to respond saying, war is the worst thing that can happen, and he doesn't believe lethal force would solve the problem. Which speaks volumes all on its own, but your again increasingly cynical host has to add, why is it that the only place the deep state warmongers don't want to wage war is on the real threats actually surrounding the United States? From Michael Snyder at the end of the American Dream, as well as a number of local sources, would you kill someone over a chicken sandwich? Well, if your answer is no, what if it was a really, really tasty chicken sandwich? Well, anyway, the headline for his piece is entitled, Another Sign of the Times. After a 2-month wait, Popeye's spicy chicken sandwich finally returned on Sunday. It was called National Sandwich Day, and fans in many locations started lining up well before stores opened at 10 o'clock. I'd never heard of one of these, writes Snyder, and there isn't a Popeye's close to where I live. But in the frenzy, we certainly did witness a number of violent incidents. It's even being reported that one man was actually stabbed to death at a Popeye's in Maryland over a sandwich. Just how far gone, he writes, do you have to be to stab someone over something so vitally important? And if people are getting this crazy now, just what are they going to do once things really start getting bad in formerly free America? Well, folks, hopefully the answer is not to turn into either disarm Mexico or nutcase California. And as a case in point, I'll turn back to another story, surprisingly, from the Daily Mail, which actually reports on something you might have thought only the NRA magazine's Armed Citizen column would want to talk about. Heavily pregnant Florida mother, says the headline, used an AR-15, who could have thought it, to kill a home intruder after two men burst into their Florida home, pistol-whipped her husband. He needed 20 stitches and 3 staples in his head following the attack, and then grabbed their 11-year-old daughter. The brutally attacked husband, Jeremy King, said two armed masked men burst into their home in Lithia, Florida on Wednesday night, then started demanding money as they pistol-whipped him and grabbing his 11-year-old daughter. One of the men even fired a shot at his 8-month pregnant wife when she came out of the bedroom to see what the commotion was about. That turns out to have been a bad mistake. She quickly grabbed their AR-15, started shooting at the armed intruders, killing one. Which is the good news, folks. The bad news is that papers from authoritarian places like Britain, New York, or Chicago always feel the need to explain that, yes, sometimes peons actually are allowed to possess means for self-defense. Quote, the sheriff's office confirmed that the AR-15 that King's wife used was legally owned. Well, for now anyway. From the far left coast, as Californians grapple with this year's out-of-control fire season, along with roving blackouts now and communications outages to boot, President Trump has a message for the communist governor of the People's Republic. Clean up your act. Quote, from the tweet, of course. The governor of California, at Gavin Newsom, has done a terrible job of forest management. I told him from the first day we met that he must clean his forest floors, regardless of what his bosses, the environmentalists, demand of them, said the president, whereupon he threatened to withhold federal money, which California receives every time they declare a state of emergency. They must also do burns and cut fire stoppers, he continued. Every year, as the fires rage and California burns, it's the same thing. And then he comes to the federal government for dollars, dollars, dollars. No more. Get your act together, Governor. But he wasn't done. He added, you don't see close to this level of burn in other states. But our teams are working well together in putting out these massive, many fires. Whereupon he lauded firefighters and criticized California bureaucrats for throwing desperately needed water into the Pacific Ocean. quote, open up the ridiculously closed water lanes coming down from the north, he said. And while we're at it, I guess this is a good follow-up, comes via the L.A. Times, but more appropriately summarized by Tyler Durden and Zero Hedge. California conservatives, they say, are leaving the state in droves over what the L.A. Times describes as their, get this, disenchantment, to put it mildly, with deep blue state California's liberal political culture. Not to mention the high taxes, lukewarm support for local law enforcement, and policies they believe have, quote, thrown open the doors to illegal immigration, unquote. And, gee, do you think? Here's the money quote from the LA Times. Just over half of California's registered voters have considered leaving the state, according to a UC Berkeley Institute of Government Studies poll conducted for the LA Times. Republicans and conservative voters, those that haven't already left, were nearly three times as likely as their Democratic or liberal counterparts to have seriously considered moving. 40% compared with 14%, the poll found. Conservatives even mentioned taxes and California's political culture as a reason for leaving more frequently than they cited the state's soaring housing costs. And I guess the good news in this story, folks, is that maybe for the first time, Californians now fleeing the left coast might actually consider leaving their failed leftist ideology behind. While we certainly welcome good, law-abiding folks, those of us in places like Texas and Colorado have certainly seen more than enough of it. I want to spend a few minutes to down a really interesting piece I saw reprinted via Tyler Durden and Zero Hedge with the somewhat disconcerting title of An Inconvenient Truth. The best way to help the environment is to avoid so-called green or eco-friendly products. And this one's interesting because it really demonstrates the 80-20 rule. You need to know enough about evidence and science to be able to separate the wheat from the chaff. Make no mistake about it, though, the piece begins, it's now trendy to be the most planet-loving, alternative energy-supporting, climate change-fighting Captain Planet that you can be. And what would being a friend to the environment be without sanctimoniously ridiculing those who disagree with you or aren't on your level of left coast-type sustainability? Well, just ask Greta Thunberg. But as often happens with virtue signaling, especially when it runs amok, the reality of the matter is far askew from how pretentious environmentalists present it. In fact, RT reports that avoiding all of the green, eco-friendly products available on the market might very well be the best way to actually help the environment. Often lost in the fray, they say, is the fact that the fight against so-called climate change, especially, folks, the kind that isn't man-made, that is caused by the sun, and that you're not going to be able to fight anyway, other than by preparing for it, is going to make some people very wealthy. Yeah, there you go. That's the ticket. The world will invest $90 trillion, it says, in new infrastructure in order to fight non-existent man-made climate change over the next 10 to 15 years. And reports show that consumers will willingly pay more to buy sustainable, so-called earth-friendly products. Unilever says that about a third of consumers buy a brand based on its environmental impact, real or imagined. And a fifth of consumers favor what's called green messaging, according to the same data. But not all products billed to be friendly to the environment, I hope you're sitting down for this one, folks, actually are. And here's why I'm doing the piece, because they start off with the 20% that's bogus. For example, they say, organic farming, quote, isn't the planet saver it's promoted to be, according to a study published last month in Nature Communications, which shows that farming crops like beans, potatoes, and oats organically actually creates more emissions over the entire course of the farm-to-table cycle than conventional Monsanto-approved farming. Quote, trying to get all of Britain, for example, eating organic would create an environmental catastrophe, said researchers at Cranfield University. I can't help but note they do kind of ignore whether it would produce more healthy Brits, though. Why, you might be asking? Well, because you can get more bogus crops per acre out of the crappy stuff. And you can feed more people, even though they won't get as much actual nutrition. And if they die off early, I guess that helps reduce the surplus population to boot. Says the piece here, organic farming actually requires more land than conventional farming. Well, did you catch that? Conventional farming. Once upon a time, folks, all farming was organic farming because the non-chemical variety yields a smaller harvest per acre. And that would raise carbon costs sky high, despite what they admit are the benefits of soil and water health improving dramatically without the nasty runoff from regular farming. But still, they note, it would be impossible to lower dreaded carbon dioxide emissions without a, quote, major shift in diet, unquote. And that, after all, is the intent, isn't it? And here's the line that inspired me to do this particular story. All of this, said RT, puts farmers into a precarious position. The uncomfortable position of having to choose between what your host suggests is a false dichotomy. A bogus non-choice. On the one hand, protecting biodiversity, because popular neonicotinoid pesticides have been implicated in the mass deaths of things like bees, critical to maintaining adequate food supplies via pollination, and the bogus goal of lowering carbon emissions and reducing the dreaded carbon footprint. And so they admit a one-size-fits-all approach is unlikely to work. Of course, if we get rid of false choices and false dichotomies, folks, we can make far more educated choices, which is why there's such a push on to dumb kids down in school rather than teaching them to actually look at cause and effect. Now, here they actually make a good point. So-called renewable energy, including solar, is not really as green as it sounds, because things like solar panel manufacturing are a, quote, toxic mess. Full stop here, and time for a fact injection. While they finally get around to admitting that things like solar and wind all require lots of energy to produce in the first place, they ignore the real economic and scientific issue. Your host isn't alone in calling it energy density. Over the lifetime of an energy-generating product, actually how much real energy then does it put out before it goes to the trash heap? And in the broader sense, the term applies not only to fuels. Gasoline is a lot more energy-dense than, say, sugar or ethanol. Diesel or kerosene has about 3 times the energy density of wood. But the concept applies, too, to the machines that first produce and then utilize that energy. Because it's the total over the lifespan that really determines whether that society is able to produce more energy than it uses and thus grows or decays. And look no further than petroleum for the obvious historic example. Relatively low energy input required to find it, drill it, produce it, refine it, and then burn and use it, including building everything from refineries and plants to smelters, to internal combustion engines, to jet engines, with lots and lots left over to harvest and plant all kinds of crops, and thus grow a lot more food to feed a whole lot more people than could ever be done with manpower, horsepower, and ox power. So compare that now to a gallon of ethanol to run a car, or for crying out laughably loud, a farm tractor. Turns out that a gallon of ethanol costs basically about as much energy to plant, harvest, and then distill into a usable fuel as it actually returns when you try to use it. So with nothing left over, and basically a lifespan energy density less than 1, a society that tried to run that way would simply run down. So they're ignoring the all-important point. Low-density renewable energy that returns less total energy over its lifespan than it took to produce it in the first place is a guaranteed long-term loser. Back now to the piece. Electric vehicles, too, who could have imagined this, have a dark side. More energy is consumed in the production of electric cars than of gas cars. Let's be honest, folks. More energy and more pollution is produced in the production of electric cars than they'll ever return over the gas cars over their lifetime, especially when you count things like disposal of short-lived batteries and the uncomfortable fact that somehow the electricity has to be produced to charge the cars, and often it comes from burning the dreaded fossil fuels. They'd be better off just burning the fuels while they drove, rather than the dramatic inefficiencies of producing, shipping, charging, and storing energy in inefficient batteries. The piece concludes by saying companies are scrambling to try to look as green as possible, eager to give consumers the idea that they're making a difference while they're really not, allowing them to pat themselves on the back for being so green while they're actually not having to sacrifice anything. But the truth, folks, is far more insidious than that. While they're feeling good about feeling green and being stupid, they're not only poisoning themselves, but destroying their children's children's future. If you think about it, it's like a deep state double whammy. We'll pick it up there when we get back. We'll be right back.
Did you write the book of love? And do you have faith in God above? If the Bible tells you so. And do you believe in rock and roll? Can music save your mortal soul?
Welcome back now to the second segment for this evening. This is Mark Call. And let's kick off this segment with a reminder that sometimes the truth does, at least belatedly, come out. Sidney Powell, the new lawyer for General Michael Flynn, is now pulling on a thread, says Thomas Lifson at the American Thinker, as well as the conservative Treehouses of Sundance, to unravel the conspiracy to commit a coup and overturn the election that's already been successful in getting him to cop a plea to a crime he almost certainly didn't commit. But Sidney Powell keeps managing to extract information from the criminally evil FBI, proving basically beyond any doubt that they've been lying about almost everything since the get-go. On Tuesday, yet another admission came out, which typically strains credulity, that it's for years misattributed authorship of the very notes used in preparing the so-called Form 302 interview summaries that were altered to incriminate Flynn. And this, of course, is why they don't actually record the interviews. Better to be able to manipulate them later, it would seem. And in this case, it turns out they can't even keep the liar straight. Yes, says the letter. Well, we're really sorry, but the notes that we had identified originally as being from Peter the criminal Strzok were actually the other unnamed agent's notes, and vice versa. Now, admittedly, folks, the first thing your host thought of when I heard this obviously not credible claim was, all the better to be able to say, hey, that way our testimony, which doesn't line up to begin with, has an excuse that doesn't result in us going to jail for perjury. How convenient. And you gotta love BS like this from the FBI. Quote, we understand that this has caused some confusion, and we regret our error. No, they don't, folks. The whole point of the lie was to cause exactly this kind of confusion and hopefully get away with it. They almost did. Here's the excellent summary from Sundance. The entire FBI case against Flynn, meaning the central element that he was supposedly lying to FBI investigators, guess who the liars really turned out to be, is predicated on the 302 interview reports generated by those two FBI agents, later discovered to have been edited, shaped, and approved by McCabe. Oh, Lisa Page seems to have had a hand in it, too. And for almost 2 years, the entire outline of the documented evidence has now been, as we find out, misattributed. And interestingly, what triggered this re-review of the lying notes was the observation from the new defense that highlighted how Peter Strzok's so-called notes were far too neat, organized, and well-constructed to have actually been written during the process of the interview, like was claimed. And for the prosecution to now reverse course and say, oh, we screwed up, we misattributed and transposed the interviews, is the biggest admitted screw-up in the high-profile case so far. And obviously, the real issue here is skullduggery, rather than simply an honest mistake. And by the way, folks, when honest mistakes like this happen in real criminal prosecutions, the charges are generally dropped. Retired 30-year FBI agent Mark Wauk adds these comments as to what's really going on here. I guarantee you, he said, based on 30 years of doing interviews, taking notes, reading, or attempting to read notes taken by other agents, these notes certainly don't look like notes taken during an actual interview. They look instead like a rough draft done afterwards, which, he said, leads to another question. Who does a handwritten rough draft of an interview these days? I stopped doing that, he says, decades ago, once I had access to a computer. I took my notes, sat down in front of the computer, and started typing. So why would Joe Pienka or Peter Strzok, whichever one it might have been, bother to produce a handwritten draft? That is, if we accept the rest of this as true anyway. Here's why. Because that handwritten draft, quote, could be changed at will, whereas nowadays, once you save something under a case file number, even as a draft, that's recoverable. There's an audit trail, which is what Powell keeps asking for. So if you're an investigator, he puts it in quotes, and you're not sure how you want to make the interview sound, then you delay creating that discoverable digital trail. And that's a sure indicator, he says, of a dishonest intent, unquote. And just how many more indicators like that are we going to need before the American people wake up and say, good grief, haven't we had enough of this charade? From there, on we go to another one that does admittedly require more biblical literacy to put in proper perspective than you're likely to find in the vast majority of what passes for press nowadays. This story, though, comes originally from Dr. Thomas D. Williams at Breitbart about a group known as the Christian Hymn Society, which he says has released a collection entitled, ready, Songs for the Holy other. Hymns affirming the LGBTQIA2S plus community, intended for liturgical use in the United States and Trudeau's new Islamic Republic of Canada. Now here's where we stop, folks, and make the first observation from Scripture and from an understanding of the Hebrew language. The word that's translated into English as holy, that's H-O-L-Y as opposed to W-H-O-L-L-Y, is really kadosh in Hebrew, and more appropriately, it means set apart. And what's interesting about that word is that the word set apart can apply to something that's set apart because it's set apart to Yah, as the holy priesthood was, or because it's set apart to some other pagan gods, in which case it's set apart for the exact opposite reason. So, when you read Songs for the Holy Other, in context, that makes the implication a lot more obvious. It's set apart to something that certainly is other than the God of the Bible. And the next paragraph makes it clear why. Among the nearly 50 so-called queer hymns featured in this abominable collection are, quote, God of Queer Transgressive Spaces, one called Quirky, Queer, and Wonderful. Oh, and the unforgettable, quote, The Kingdom of God is the Queerest of Nations, unquote. See what I mean? The so-called Ecumenical Nonprofit Hymn Society released their so-called hymnal in July, but it's just now been publicized courtesy of the Anglican Journal, the publication of the Anglican Church of Canada, which praised the work for offering, quote, further potential for music as a source of affirmation and inclusion. Sydney Brouillard Coyle, the, quote, gender nonconforming music director at St. Paul's Anglican Church in Essex, Ontario, called the collection, quote, an amazing resource for music directors and for priests, sick, who are looking for hymns that are affirming for the LGBT community, unquote. Yeah, the fact that they're antithetical to Scripture is clearly just a bonus. The preface to this abominable so-called collection of hymns for the holy other than the scriptural version of God says, in our society and in our churches, and right there they're outlining the difference, we continue to build walls marking out and in, the text reads. We continue to mark boundaries of us and them, of normal and other. I could add things like, oh, of sin and not sin, or cursing versus blessing, of abomination and set apart unto the real God. But Songs for the Holy Other aims to provide congregations working against the Word of God to dismantle these walls with a toolbox of hymns of and for those who identify as belonging to groups that Scripture says are guilty of any number of different forms of rebellion to His written Word. How long, folks, until we see hymns for the holy thieves and hymns for the holy pedophiles and hymns for the holy... Well, wait a minute. Maybe they're already being distributed to members of Congress. And here may be the coup de grace of this whole thing, folks. The preface of that book also explains that the title of the collection, Songs for the Holy Other, is a, quote, self-conscious claiming of otherness as being set apart. They use the term holy and beloved of God. And since we now understand what it's being set apart to as opposed to set apart from, i.e. Yahuwah, the God of the Bible, I guess it's equally obvious which other they mean. I will, however, concede this. You could at least argue they're a bit more honest when it comes to whom they serve than the federal bunglers of investigations. And since basically everything we've seen in the news for quite a while now seems to point directly towards coming Civil War 2.0, which is already in progress but not yet quite hot, if you want to use that term, I go next to some pretty, well, let's call them cogent and also thought-provoking arguments from Mike Adams at Natural News in a piece entitled 25 Mind-Blowing Things That Are Likely to Happen If the Dems, his term, I would say outright communist, Bolshevik 2.0, etc., succeed in removing the duly elected President Trump from office. And he begins the movement to do so by any means necessary. Is now gaining steam. What with the collusion of the deep state media, CIA operatives, and anti-Trump tech giants, all of which tend to censor all truth, the deep state, he writes, is hoping to crush, well, democracy. I do wish these people would get it right, folks. The problem is, democracy is crushing the form of government Ben Franklin warned that we might not be able to keep. And here we are with most people, even some of the really good ones, still not able to actually read the Constitution and say, what form of government have you really given us? Answer, a republic, if you can keep it. And obviously, that's over by now. Anyway, he says, it's all about destroying Trump and installing none other than Hitlery as the next dictator of the United States, probably well before the election. Should they succeed in achieving a Senate conviction of Trump, which would remove him from office, well, if they don't just do it some other way in the meanwhile, here, he says, are 25 shocking, history-changing events that we may see unfold. Now, I might not get through all 25, may not even try to. Some of them make more sense than others. But he does note that the author doesn't condone any of the actions outlined below. This is an analysis, not a call for action. And a lot of the things he foresees coming are truly horrific, something nobody would want. Well, nobody outside of the Bolshevik left, anyway. Because they describe, for example, mass executions and other horrific crimes. So we certainly hope that none of this comes to pass. But in all likelihood, folks, and this is my reason for doing it, more than some of this most certainly will. Number one, the stock market will implode. Now, I'll suggest that's going to happen anyway. If not before, then in conjunction with the dollar collapse. All of this, though, is because Trump seems to be the only person, says Adams, remaining in Washington District of Criminals who doesn't want it to collapse. If any of the Dems seize power, he writes, expect a collapse of the U.S. stock market as well as U.S. economic activity, while investors and anybody who's hiring people for a living heads for the exits, and Democrats will thus thrust America into an economic nosedive of Venezuelan scale. Number two, once Trump is impeached and removed from office by hook or by crook, the focus will then shift immediately to removing Mike Pence, too, so that Nancy Pelosi, the one they really want in there, current speaker for the traitors, can become president without an election. Hey, did you ever notice how just about the only part of the Constitution that so much of Congress has ever bothered to read has to do with the order of succession? After which, and this is at least an interesting speculation, and probably not all that far-fetched, she'll immediately push to nominate and have Hillary Clinton confirmed as vice president, which, even though it might require Senate confirmation, is pretty much a gimme, given that Republicans will by then have proven that they've lost any backbone to prevent the conviction of Trump, so they'll have no resistance whatsoever to the logical follow-up. Because, number four, by this point, the Republican Party as such will have proven that it's not even a loyal opposition and folded into oblivion. The question your host adds to this one is, will anybody in America, outside of the Rand Paul crowd, even notice? Number five, he says, it's possible President Trump could form his own political party and run for president again, because then he'd be able to serve two more terms, his first one having been nullified by the impeachment effort. Nah, on second thought, I should have just skipped over that. Who are we kidding? Open civil war certainly makes a lot more sense, for a whole bunch of reasons. Number six, after removing Trump from office and installing Hitlery as dictator for life, I guess nutcase Nancy will have abdicated by then and gone back to running the asylum for the new regime. Democrats will immediately begin, he suggests, to work to reverse all of anything Trump ever did, from his Supreme Court nominees, people like Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. Yeah, I'll spare you his description, but picture three-ring circus parts 3, 4, 5 ad infinitum, however long it takes, to his federal judge nominations, to ultimately every executive order, international agreement, or treaty signed by Trump, with the claim that each and every single one of them is and always was null and void. Because, you know, the wrong person won the election. It took almost 3 years to get American democracy back on the totalitarian track. All right, well, basically those first 9 or so elements were set up for number 10 here, and this is the place where your host thinks it gets interesting and probably a lot more likely. It's unlikely, he says, that all of these Democrat nullification actions will ever succeed, because the moment Trump is convicted, or as your host would suggest, possibly even when the impeachment is a done deal, especially without a better sales job than they've managed so far, America will very likely, he says, see a massive patriot uprising against the obviously beyond corrupt establishment, culminating in perhaps 1 million or so legally armed Americans, if such a thing can still be said to exist, converging on the District of Criminals swamp, where they'll demand the arrest and indictment of every last treasonous piece of D.C. filth who voted for the impeachment in the House or the Senate. Before long, suggests Adams, it may look like swamp rat season in the District of Criminals, and the new president, for a while anyway, Nancy Pelosi, will no doubt invoke the very same insurrection act that President Trump should be invoking right now to drain the swamp. All of which will result in the U.S. military being ordered to defend that president, not this one, against the million armed Americans determined to oppose the illegal coup and defend what they will consider to be the real president, meaning Trump, from the lawless deep state that fabricated everything to illegally and, yeah, unconstitutionally remove him from power. The net effect of all of this will be a civil war within the military itself that then spills out into the streets of the once United States. And here, of course, is where things get a heck of a lot more chaotic and perhaps more difficult to predict, although, as he points out, there are some obvious elements that probably should be included. Number 11, as part of the uprising, patriot groups will almost certainly target the complicit media organizations that took part in the illegal coup, meaning fake propaganda hubs like the New York Times, WAPO, and, of course, Clinton News Network should expect to have their fake reporters arrested and indicted, or something anyway, for criminal conspiracy to commit treason. And don't expect all of this to stop at the takedown of the fake news media either. There are tech giants likely to be on the list, whose CEOs could be arrested and imprisoned for systematically violating the civil rights of millions of Americans through censorship and election rigging, including, of course, the obvious ones, Gulag, to Facebook, YouTube, Vimeo, Snapchat, Twitter, down to Pinterest and other anti-American, anti-speech tech giants, all of whom have been complicit in what's going on, and in taking part in what he probably correctly calls the coordinated theft of the 2018 midterm elections. And there should be repercussions at the state level, too, suggests Mike Adams. State-level representatives could face arrest and indictments for their roles in things like gutting the Second Amendment, red flag confiscation, and, of course, protection of the so-called rights of illegals rather than actual Americans to whom they swore an oath before God. And, says Adams, there are already plans in place, as we've seen across various posts on the net, for patriot groups to carry out mass arrests of state representatives in places like California, New York, Colorado, and other states. And here maybe he's a bit too optimistic, saying the days of state senators and so-called lawmakers violating the God-given rights constitutionally protected as they once were of Americans while protecting criminal illegal aliens might soon be coming to a close. Would that that part of this were true, at any rate. Number 14, as the uprising continues, watch for law enforcement groups, the real ones, to literally hunt down and eliminate, he says, Antifa members nationwide. Because the days of deranged, lunatic, left-wing mobs attacking police officers on the street might even come to a close when they decide they too have had enough. Under the new rulers of the Dems, force has already become the final rule. And when it comes to that kind of force, notes Adams, cops ought to outgun most leftists. Note, he says, I'm not calling for this, just analyzing what's probably coming. Number 15, as the Civil War explodes across America, we'll almost certainly see power grid disconnections from the liberal stronghold cities, used as a tactic to plunge those cities into even greater chaos, as if that would be necessary. Watch for tactical disruptions of fuel, food, water, and electricity. Or come to think of it, you could just move to California right now, suggests Adams, and let PG&E do it for you. Note that over the last 30 days, millions of Californians have already been exposed to what lost power and blackouts look like because of California's criminal politicians who falsely claim that it's high winds. Absurd though that might be, in a dumbed-down America, they think they can get away with that. Wind, of course, says Adams, doesn't cause power lines to spontaneously combust. In truth, it's the fact that California's power grid is collapsing that really ought to be covered here, and wind is just the excuse to cover up the reality. The fact is, California doesn't have the power generating capacity to feed its grid anymore, and they're making false excuses up for shutting things down. He quotes several comments from a piece by the Omaha World Herald entitled Days of Terrifying Darkness, Cold, and Hunger Amid PG&E's Sweeping Power Blackouts. Oh, and communications disruptions, too. Your longtime ham radio operator host has pointed out recently just how insidious what they're doing really is. As we've seen, when the power grid goes down, these areas lose communications from cell phones and radio and TV towers to the Internet. which explains why downright evil bureaucrats in California are so dead set on ordering ham radio repeaters that provide backup emergency communications in these areas to leave, to get off their sacred mountains and out of their forests. Like they're anxious to keep people literally in the dark in more ways than one. And with that in mind, I'll read one quote from this Omaha story by Annette Carter, who said concerning the blackouts, quote, "Not only are we in the dark, it's almost like we're completely shut off from the world, and that makes it even more terrifying. I can handle a lot of stuff, but my kids being in fear and not being able to reach out to the world and find out what's going on, that's problematic," unquote. And that, folks, is intentional. Now, here is the other side of the coin. Should this patriot uprising, as Adams calls it, fail to take down the enemies of America? And here your host has to interject the following. As horrific as a civil war will no doubt be, the only thing that actually might end up being far worse is if America goes down into the totalitarian toilet with a whimper rather than a bang. So here, too, your host tends to concur with Mike Adams, who said, should this patriot uprising fail to take down America's enemies within, we'll see Democrats seize total power and shift openly into the violent authoritarian phase, with a complete nationwide police state, total control over all speech, and the targeted executions of their political opponents. He calls it a political holocaust of death to conservatives, writing that leftists will coordinate with the deep state and the complicit media to call for and condone the mass executions of any and all who supported Trump. And let's not kid ourselves, folks, that's already in progress. Calls will go out for mass executions on the streets of America, and the lunatic left will be more than anxious to comply. And here he quotes a recent piece from Dave Hodges, citing the pretty obvious parallels between Adam Schiffless and the 1930s path of none other than Adolf Hitler. It was called America Should Expect a Holocaust to Follow Impeachment. And he says, if history sets the example, as it did in both Russia and Germany, the coup will be two stages. Stage one will compromise the Republicans and target people like Rand Paul and Louis Gohmert as being enemies of the state. Writes Hodges, I expect MS-13, the assassins of choice for the drug cartels, to be the executioners. And, of course, they are already in place, distributed to numbers of cities all across America. And Hodges isn't the only one to note that people who can tolerate the harvesting of baby parts and organs probably won't object too much when they see the same thing happening to their fellow citizens after being accused of the kind of crimes we're seeing propagandized and popularized right now. Mike Adams' number 17 is the complete censorship, as if we aren't pretty much already there, of all conservatives, Trump supporters, Christians, Bible believers, and gun owners who weren't already executed by the left-wing mobs. And that'll include ratcheting up of the tech giant censorship to even more extreme levels. Popular browsers, and those will be the only ones you'll be allowed to have, will block all websites labeled disinformation by Big Brother's Ministry of Propaganda, forcing independent media to go completely underground or return to old-school techniques to share information, things like printing hard copies. Remember the old mimeograph? Sharing thumb drives or operating on the dark net. They got a fix for that, though, too. 5G is coming, and the Internet of Things will be watching, but other than that, pretty soon, without the mark, you won't be allowed to access the Internet at all. Number 18, the complete elimination, of course, of the Second Amendment and nationwide gun confiscation. Now here, folks, although the propaganda moves are obvious by this point, I think Adams gets the time sequence wrong. Hitler, of course, famously made possession of any kind of a weapon a capital offense. But an open attempt at door-to-door gun confiscation in most of America, outside of the leftist cities, would certainly lead to that civil war, which some of them may be anxious to provoke anyway. Adams suggests, hopefully correctly, that goon squads attempting to engage in gun confiscation would probably be targeted by millions of armed Americans, guerrilla-style, and that the average lifespan of those stupid enough to do so would be pretty short, which is why your host suggests we'll continue to see the subtle approach, Walmart-style. Tax and then ban ammo. Track and red flag sales. Demonize those who actually want to keep and bear arms and so forth. And we can expect the crackdown on the First Amendment to march in jackbooted lockstep with all of that. And interestingly, folks, as we wrap it up for today, Adams doesn't even mention the likely invasion from without that would accompany this kind of turmoil within. But he does absolutely get this part right. This, as we've long known, is a spiritual battle between good and evil. Just about everywhere you look, folks, and we've talked about several of those today, there's simply no way to deny it any longer. And this battle is for more than just your lives. It really is time to pray, be thankful for what we've had, and be prepared for what's coming. And more, it looks like that's sooner rather than later.